Ulysses, Disc 20.
Episode 13. The summer evening had begun to fold the world in its mysterious embrace. Far away in the west, the sun was setting, and the last glow of all too fleeting day lingered lovingly on sea and strand, on the proud promontory of dear old Hoth, guarding as ever the waters of the bay, on the weed-grown rocks along Sandymount shore, and last but not least, on the quiet church, whence there streamed forth at times upon the stillness the voice of prayer, to her who is in her pure radiance a beacon ever to the storm-tossed heart of man, Mary, Star of the Sea. The three girlfriends were seated on the rocks, enjoying the evening scene and the air, which was fresh but not too chilly. Many a time and oft were they wont to come there to that favourite nook, to have a cosy chat beside the sparkling waves, and discuss matters feminine. Sissy Caffrey and Edie Boardman, with the baby in the pushcar, and Tommy and Jackie Caffrey, two little curly-headed boys dressed in sailor suits with caps to match, and the name HMS Belle Isle printed on both. For Tommy and Jack Caffrey were twins, scarce 4 years old, and very noisy and spoiled twins sometimes. But for all that, darling little fellows with bright merry faces and endearing ways about them. They were dabbling in the sand with their spades and buckets, building castles as children do, or playing with their big coloured ball, happy as the day was long. And Edie Boardman was rocking the chubby baby to and fro in the pushcar, while that young gentleman fairly chuckled with delight. He was but 11 months and 9 days old, and though still a tiny toddler, was just beginning to lisp his first babyish words. Sissy Caffrey bent over to him to tease his fat little plucks and the dainty dimple in his chin. "Now, baby," Sissy Caffrey said, "say out, big, big, I want a drink of water." And baby prattled after her,
"A chink, a chink, a chobo."
Sissy Caffrey cuddled the wee chap, for she was awfully fond of children, so patient with little sufferers, and Tommy Caffrey could never be got to take his castor oil unless it was Sissy Caffrey that held his nose and promised him the scatty heel of the loaf or brown bread with golden syrup on. What a persuasive power that girl had! But to be sure, baby Boardman was as good as gold, a perfect little dote in his new fancy bib. None of your spoilt beauties, Flora MacFlimsey sort, was Sissy Caffrey. A truer-hearted lass never drew the breath of life, always with a laugh in her gypsy-like eyes and a frolicsome word on her cherry-ripe red lips. A girl lovable in the extreme. And Edie Boardman laughed too at the quaint language of little brother. But just then there was a slight altercation between Master Tommy and Master Jackie. Boys will be boys, and our two twins were no exception to this golden rule. The apple of discord was a certain castle of sand, which Master Jackie had built, and Master Tommy would have it, right go wrong, that it was to be architecturally improved by a front door, like the Martello Tower had. But if Master Tommy was headstrong, Master Jackie was self-willed too. And, true to the maxim that every little Irishman's house is his castle, he fell upon his hated rival, and to such purpose that the would-be assailant came to grief, and, alas to relate, the coveted castle too. Needless to say, the cries of discomfited Master Tommy drew the attention of the girlfriends. "Come here, Tommy," his sister called imperatively. "At once. And you, Jackie, for shame to throw poor Tommy in the dirty sand. Wait till I catch you for that." His eyes misty with unshed tears, Master Tommy came at her call, for their big sister's word was law with the twins. And in a sad plight he was too, after his misadventure. His little man-o'-war top and unmentionables were full of sand. But Sissy was a past mistress in the art of smoothing over life's tiny troubles, and very quickly not one speck of sand was to be seen on his smart little suit. Still, the blue eyes were glistening with hot tears that would well up, so she kissed away the hurtness and shook her hand at Master Jackie, the culprit, and said if she was near him, she wouldn't be far from him, her eyes dancing in admonition. "Nasty, bold Jackie!" she cried. She put an arm round the little mariner and coaxed winningly. "What's your name? Butter and Cream?" "Tell us who is your sweetheart," spoke Edie Boardman. "Is Sissy your sweetheart?"
"No,"
tearful Tommy said. "Is Edie Boardman your sweetheart?" Sissy queried.
"No,"
Tommy said. "I know," Edie Boardman said, none too amiably, with an arch glance from her short-sighted eyes. "I know who is Tommy's sweetheart. Gertie is Tommy's sweetheart."
"No,"
Tommy said on the verge of tears. Sissy's quick mother wit guessed what was amiss, and she whispered to Edie Boardman to take him there behind the pushcar, where the gentleman couldn't see, and to mind he didn't wet his new tan shoes. But who was Gertie? Gertie MacDowell, who was seated near her companions, lost in thought, gazing far away into the distance, was, in very truth, as fair a specimen of winsome Irish girlhood as one could wish to see. She was pronounced beautiful by all who knew her, though, as folks often said, she was more a Giltrap than a MacDowell. Her figure was slight and graceful, inclining even to fragility, but those iron geloids she had been taking of late had done her a world of good, much better than the Widow Welch's female pills. And she was much better of those discharges she used to get, and that tired feeling. The waxen pallor of her face was almost spiritual in its ivory-like purity, though her rosebud mouth was a genuine Cupid's bow, Greekly perfect. Her hands were a finely veined alabaster, with tapering fingers, and as white as lemon juice and queen of ointments could make them. Though it was not true that she used to wear kid gloves in bed or take a milk foot bath either. Bertha Supple told that once to Edie Boardman, a deliberate lie, when she was black out at daggers drawn with Gertie. The girl chums had, of course, their little tiffs from time to time, like the rest of mortals, and she told her not to let on, whatever she did, that it was her that told her, or she'd never speak to her again. No, honour where honour is due. There was an innate refinement, a languid, queenly hauteur about Gertie, which was unmistakably evidenced in her delicate hands and high-arched instep. Had kind fate but willed her to be born a gentlewoman of high degree in her own right, and had she only received the benefit of a good education, Gertie MacDowell might easily have held her own beside any lady in the land, and have seen herself exquisitely gowned, with jewels on her brow and patrician suitors at her feet, vying with one another to pay their devoirs to her. Mayhap it was this, the love that might have been, that lent to her softly featured face, at whiles, a look tense with suppressed meaning, that imparted a strange yearning tendency to the beautiful eyes, a charm few could resist. Why have women such eyes of witchery? Gertie's were of the bluest Irish blue, set off by lustrous lashes and dark, expressive brows. Time was when those brows were not so silkily seductive. It was Madame Vera Verity, directress of the Woman Beautiful page of the Princess Novelette, who had first advised her to try eyebrow line, which gave that haunting expression to the eyes, so becoming in leaders of fashion, and she had never regretted it. Then there was blushing, scientifically cured, and how to be tall, increase your height, and you have a beautiful face, but your nose? That would suit Mrs. Dignam, because she had a button one. But Gertie's crowning glory was her wealth of wonderful hair. It was dark brown with a natural wave in it. She had cut it that very morning on account of the new moon, and it nestled about her pretty head in a profusion of luxuriant clusters. And pared her nails, too. Thursday for wealth. And just now, at Edie's words as a telltale flush, delicate as the faintest rose bloom crept into her cheeks, she looked so lovely in her sweet girlish shyness that of a surety God's fair land of Ireland did not hold her equal. For an instant she was silent, with rather sad downcast eyes. She was about to retort, but something checked the words on her tongue. Inclination prompted her to speak out. Dignity told her to be silent. The pretty lips pouted a while, but then she glanced up and broke out into a joyous little laugh, which had in it all the freshness of a young May morning. She knew right well, no one better, what made Squinty Edie say that, because of him cooling in his attentions when it was simply a lover's quarrel. As per usual, somebody's nose was out of joint about the boy that had the bicycle off the London Bridge Road, always riding up and down in front of her window. Only now his father kept him in the evenings, studying hard to get an exhibition in the intermediate that was on, and he was going to go to Trinity College to study for a doctor when he left the high school like his brother W.E. Wiley, who was racing in the bicycle races in Trinity College University. Little recked he, perhaps, for what she felt, that dull, aching void in her heart sometimes, piercing to the core. Yet he was young, and perchance he might learn to love her in time. They were Protestants in his family, and of course Gertie knew who came first, and after him the Blessed Virgin, and then St. Joseph. But he was undeniably handsome, with an exquisite nose, and he was what he looked, every inch a gentleman. The shape of his head, too, at the back without his cap on, that she would know anywhere. Something off the common, and the way he turned the bicycle at the lamp with his hands off the bars, and also the nice perfume of those good cigarettes, and besides, they were both of a size too, he and she, and that was why Edie Boardman thought she was so frightfully clever, because he didn't go and ride up and down in front of her bit of a garden. Gertie was dressed simply, but with the instinctive taste of a votary of dame fashion, for she felt that there was just a mite that he might be out. A neat blouse of electric blue, self-tinted by dolly dyes, because it was expected in the ladies' pictorial that electric blue would be worn, with a smart V opening down to the division, and kerchief pocket in which she always kept a piece of cotton wool scented with her favourite perfume, because the handkerchief spoiled the sit, and a navy three-quarter skirt, cut to the stride, showed off her slim, graceful figure to perfection. She wore a coquettish little love of a hat of wide-leaf nigger straw, contrast-trimmed with an underbrim of egg-blue chenille, and at the side a butterfly bow of silk to tone. All Tuesday week afternoon she was hunting to match that chenille, but at last she found what she wanted at Cleary Summer Sales, the very it. Slightly shop-soiled, but you would never notice. Seven fingers, two and a penny. She did it up all by herself, and what joy was hers when she tried it on then, smiling at the lovely reflection which the mirror gave back to her. And when she put it on the water jug to keep the shape, she knew that that would take the shine out of some people she knew. Her shoes were the newest thing in footwear. Edie Boardman prided herself that she was very petite, but she never had a foot like Gertie MacDowell. 5. I never would. Ash, oak or elm. With patent toe caps and just one smart buckle over her high arched instep. Her well-turned ankle displayed its perfect proportions beneath her skirt, and just the proper amount, and no more, of her shapely limbs encased in fine-spun hose, with high-spliced heels and wide garter tops. As for undies, they were Gertie's chief care, and who that knows the fluttering hopes and fears of sweet 17, though Gertie would never see 17 again, can find it in his heart to blame her. She had 4 dinky sets with awfully pretty stitchery, 3 garments and nighties extra, and each set slotted with different coloured ribbons, rose pink, pale blue, mauve and pea green. And she aired them herself and blued them when they came home from the wash, and ironed them, and she had a brickbat to keep the iron on, because she wouldn't trust those washerwomen as far as she'd see them scorching the things. She was wearing the blue for luck, hoping against hope. Her own colour, and lucky too for a bride to have a bit of blue somewhere on her. Because the green she wore that day week brought grief, because his father brought him in to study for the intermediate exhibition. And because she thought perhaps he might be out, because when she was dressing that morning, she nearly slipped up the old pair on her inside out. And that was for luck and lovers' meeting, if you put those things on inside out, or if they got untied, that he was thinking about you so long as it wasn't of a Friday. And yet, that strained look on her face, a gnawing sorrow is there all the time. Her very soul is in her eyes, and she would give worlds to be in the privacy of her own familiar chamber, where, giving way to tears, she could have a good cry and relieve her pent-up feelings, though not too much, because she knew how to cry nicely before the mirror. "You are lovely, Gertie," it said. The paly light of evening falls upon a face infinitely sad and wistful. Gertie MacDowell yearns in vain. Yes, she had known from the very first that her daydream of a marriage has been arranged and the wedding bells ringing for Mrs. Reggie Wiley, T.C.D., because the one who married the elder brother would be Mrs. Wiley, and in the fashionable intelligence Mrs. Gertrude Wiley was wearing a sumptuous confection of grey trimmed with expensive blue fox, was not to be. He was too young to understand. He would not believe in love, a woman's birthright. The night of the party long ago in stores, he was still in short trousers, when they were alone and he stole an arm round her waist. She went white to the very lips. He called her little one in a strangely husky voice and snatched a half kiss. The first. But it was only the end of her nose, and then he hastened from the room with a remark about refreshments. Impetuous fellow. Strength of character had never been Reggie Wiley's strong point, and he who would woo and win Gertie MacDowell must be a man among men. But waiting, always waiting to be asked, and it was leap year too, and would soon be over. No Prince Charming is her beau ideal to lay a rare and wondrous love at her feet, but rather a manly man with a strong, quiet face, who had not found his ideal. Perhaps his hair slightly flecked with grey, and who would understand, take her in his sheltering arms, strain her to him in all the strength of his deep, passionate nature, and comfort her with a long, long kiss. It would be like heaven. For such a one she yearns, this balmy summer eve. With all the heart of her, she longs to be his only, his affianced bride, for riches for poor, in sickness, in health, till death us two part, from this to this day forward. And while Edie Boardman was with little Tommy behind the pushcar, she was just thinking, would the day ever come when she could call herself his little wife-to-be? Then they could talk about her till they went blue in the face. Bertha Supple, too, and Edie, little spitfire, because she would be 22 in November. She would care for him with creature comforts, too, for Gertie was womanly wise and knew that a mere man liked that feeling of hominess. Her griddle cakes donned to a golden brown hue, and Queen Anne's pudding of delightful creaminess had won golden opinions from all, because she had a lucky hand also for lighting a fire, dredge in the fine self-raising flour, and always stir in the same direction, then cream the milk and sugar, and whisk well the white of eggs. Though she didn't like the eating part when there were any people that made her shy, and often she wondered why you couldn't eat something poetical, like violets or roses, and they would have a beautifully appointed drawing-room, with pictures and engravings, and the photograph of Grandpapa Giltrap's lovely dog, Gary Owen, that almost talked, it was so human, and chintz covers for the chairs, and that silver toast rack in Cleary's summer jumble sales, like they have in rich houses. He would be tall with broad shoulders. She had always admired tall men for a husband, with glistening white teeth under his carefully trimmed, sweeping moustache. And they would go on the continent for their honeymoon, 3 wonderful weeks, and then, when they settled down in a nice, snug and cosy little homely house, every morning they would both have brekkie, simple but perfectly served, for their own two selves. And before he went out to business, he would give his dear little wifey a good, hearty hug, and gaze for a moment deep down into her eyes. Edie Boardman asked Tommy Caffrey, was he done? And he said yes, so then she buttoned up his little knickerbockers for him, and told him to run off and play with Jackie, and to be good now, and not to fight. But Tommy said he wanted the ball, and Edie told him no, that Baby was playing with the ball, and if he took it, there'd be wigs on the green. But Tommy said it was his ball, and he wanted his ball, and he pranced on the ground, if you please. The temper of him! Oh, he was a man already, was little Tommy Caffrey, since he was out of pinnies. Edie told him no, no, and to be off now with him. And she told Sissy Caffrey not to give in to him. "You're not my sister," naughty Tommy said. "It's my ball." But Sissy Caffrey told Baby Boardman to look up high at her finger, and she snatched the ball quickly and threw it along the sand, and Tommy after it in full career, having won the day. "Anything for a quiet life," laughed Sis. And she tickled Tiny Tot's two cheeks to make him forget, and played "Here's the Lord Mayor, here's his two horses, here's his gingerbread carriage, and here he walks in, chin-chopper, 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 chin." But Edie got as cross as two sticks about him getting his own way like that from everyone always petting him. "I'd like to give him something," she said, "so I would. Where I won't say." "On the B.O.T., Tom," laughed Sissy merrily. Gertie MacDowell bent down her head and crimsoned at the idea of Sissy saying an unladylike thing like that out loud. She'd be ashamed of her life to say, flushing a deep rosy red, and Edie Boardman said she was sure the gentleman opposite heard what she said. But not a pin cared Sis.
"Let him,"
she said, with a pert toss of her head and a piquant tilt of her nose. "Give it to him, too, on the same place, as quick as I'd look at him." Madcap Sis with her gollywog curls. You had to laugh at her sometimes. For instance, when she asked you, would you have some more Chinese tea and jazzberry ram? And when she drew the jugs, too, and the men's faces on her nails with red ink, make you split your sides. Or when she wanted to go where you know, she said she wanted to run and pay a visit to the Miss White. That was just like Sissycums. Oh, and will you ever forget her, the evening she dressed up in her father's suit and hat and the burned cork moustache and walked down Tritonville Road smoking a cigarette. There was none to come up to her for fun. But she was sincerity itself, one of the bravest and truest hearts heaven ever made. Not one of your two-faced things, too sweet to be wholesome. And then there came out upon the air the sound of voices and the pealing anthem of the organ. It was the men's temperance retreat conducted by the missioner, the Reverend John Hughes, S.J. Rosary, sermon, and benediction of the Most Blessed Sacrament. They were there gathered together without distinction of social class, and a most edifying spectacle it was to see, in that simple fane beside the waves, after the storms of this weary world, kneeling before the feet of the Immaculate, reciting the litany of Our Lady of Loretto, beseeching her to intercede for them. The old familiar words, Holy Mary, Holy Virgin of Virgins. How sad to poor Gertie's ears. Had her father only avoided the clutches of the demon drink by taking the pledge or those powders the drink habit cured in Pearson's Weekly, she might now be rolling in her carriage, second to none. Over and over had she told herself that, as she mused by the dying embers in a brown study, without the lamp, because she hated two lights, or oftentimes gazing out of the window dreamily by the hour at the rain falling on the rusty bucket, thinking. But that vile decoction, which has ruined so many hearths and homes, had cast its shadow over her childhood days. Nay, she had even witnessed in the home circle deeds of violence caused by intemperance, and had seen her own father, a prey to the fumes of intoxication, forget himself completely. For if there was one thing of all things that Gertie knew, it was that the man who lifts his hand to a woman, save in the way of kindness, deserves to be branded as the lowest of the low. And still the voices sang in supplication to the Virgin most powerful, Virgin most merciful. And Gertie, wrapped in thought, scarce saw or heard her companions or the twins at their boyish gambols or the gentleman of Sandymount Green that Sissy Caffrey called the man that was so like himself passing along the Strand taking a short walk. You never saw him anyways screwed. But still, and for all that, she would not like him for a father, because he was too old or something, or on account of his face. It was a palpable case of Dr. Fell, or his carbuncly nose with the pimples on it, and his sandy moustache, a bit white under his nose. Poor father. With all his faults, she loved him still when he sang, Tell me, Mary, how to woo thee, or My Love and Cottage Near Rochelle. And they had stewed cockles and lettuce with Lazenby's salad dressing for supper, and when he sang The Moon Hath Raised with Mr. Dignam that died suddenly and was buried, God have mercy on him, from a stroke. Her mother's birthday, that was, and Charlie was home on his holidays,
and Tom and Mr. Dignam and Mrs. and Patsy and Freddy Dignam, and they were to have had a group taken. No one would have thought the end was so near. Now he was laid to rest. And her mother said to him to let that be a warning to him for the rest of his days, and he couldn't even go to the funeral on account of the gout, and she had to go into town to bring him the letters and samples from his office about Catesby's cork lino, artistic standard designs, fit for a palace, gives tip-top wear, and always bright and cheery in the home. A sterling, good daughter was Gertie, just like a second mother in the house, a ministering angel too, with a little heart worth its weight in gold. And when her mother had those raging, splitting headaches, who was it rubbed the menthol cone on her forehead but Gertie, though she didn't like her mother's taking pinches of snuff. And that was the only single thing they ever had words about, taking snuff. Everyone thought the world of her for her gentle ways. It was Gertie who turned off the gas at the main every night, and it was Gertie who tacked up on the wall of that place where she never forgot, every fortnight the chlorate of lime, Mr. Tunney the Grocer's Christmas Almanac, the picture of halcyon days, when a young gentleman in the costume they used to wear then, with a three-cornered hat, was offering a bunch of flowers to his lady-love, with old-time chivalry, through her lattice window. You could see there was a story behind it. The colours were done something lovely. She was in a soft, clinging white, in a studied attitude, and the gentleman was in chocolate, and he looked a thorough aristocrat. She often looked at them dreamily when she went there for a certain purpose, and felt her own arms that were white and soft, just like hers, with the sleeves back, and thought about those times because she had found out in Walker's pronouncing dictionary that belonged to Grandpapa Giltrap about the halcyon days, what they meant. The twins were now playing in the most approved brotherly fashion, till at last Master Jackie, who was really as bold as brass, there was no getting behind that, deliberately kicked the ball as hard as ever he could down towards the seaweedy rocks. Needless to say, poor Tommy was not slow to voice his dismay, but luckily the gentleman in black, who was sitting there by himself, came gallantly to the rescue and intercepted the ball. Our two champions claimed their plaything with lusty cries, and to avoid trouble, Sissy Caffrey called to the gentleman to throw it to her, please. The gentleman aimed the ball once or twice, and then threw it up the strand towards Sissy Caffrey. But it rolled down the slope and stopped right under Gertie's skirt, near the little pool by the rock. The twins clamoured again for it, and Sissy told her to kick it away and let them fight for it. So Gertie drew back her foot, but she wished their stupid ball hadn't come rolling down to her, and she gave a kick, but she missed, and Edie and Sissy laughed. "If you fail, try again," Edie Boardman said. Gertie smiled assent and bit her lip. A delicate pink crept into her pretty cheek, but she was determined to let them see, so she just lifted her skirt a little, but just enough, and took good aim and gave the ball a jolly good kick, and it went ever so far, and the two twins after it down towards the shingle. Pure jealousy, of course, it was, nothing else, to draw attention on account of the gentleman opposite looking. She felt the warm flush, a danger signal always with Gertie MacDowell, surging and flaming into her cheeks. Till then, they had only exchanged glances of the most casual. But now, under the brim of her new hat, she ventured a look at him, and the face that met her gaze there in the twilight, wan and strangely drawn, seemed to her the saddest she had ever seen. Through the open window of the church, the fragrant incense was wafted, and with it the fragrant names of her who was conceived without stain of original sin. Spiritual vessel, pray for us. Honourable vessel, pray for us. Vessel of singular devotion, pray for us. Mystical rose. And careworn hearts were there, and toilers for their daily bread, and many who had erred and wandered, their eyes wet with contrition. But for all that, bright with hope, for the Reverend Father, Father Hughes, had told them what the great Saint Bernard said in his famous prayer of Mary, the most pious Virgin's intercessory power, that it was not recorded in any age that those who implored her powerful protection were ever abandoned by her. The twins were now playing again right merrily, for the troubles of childhood are but as fleeting summer showers. Sissy Caffrey played with Baby Boardman till he crowed with glee, clapping baby hands in air. "Peep!" she cried behind the hood of the pushcar. And Edie asked, "Where was Sissy gone?" And then Sissy popped up her head and cried, "Ah! And my word, didn't the little chap enjoy that?" And then she told him to say, "Papa."
"Say, Papa, baby. Say, Pa, Pa. Pa, 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 Pa."
And Baby did his level best to say it, for he was very intelligent for 11 months, everyone said, and big for his age, and the picture of health, a perfect little bunch of love. And he would certainly turn out to be something great, they said.
"Hiya, hiya, hiya."
Sissy wiped his little mouth with a dribbling bib, and wanted him to sit up properly and say, "Pa, pa, pa." But when she undid the strap, she cried out, "Holy Saint Denis!" that he was possing wet, and to double the half-blanket the other way under him. Of course, his infant majesty was most obstreperous at such toilet formalities, and he let everyone know it.
"Ha-ba, ba, ba, ba."
And two great, big, lovely big tears coursing down his cheeks. It was all no use soothing him with, "No, no, no, baby, no," and telling him about the GG and where was the puff-puff. But Sis, always ready-witted, gave him in his mouth the teat of the sucking bottle, and the young heathen was quickly appeased. Gertie wished to goodness they would take their squalling baby home out of that, and not get on her nerves. No hour to be out, and the little brats of twins. She gazed out towards the distant sea. It was like the paintings that man used to do on the pavement with all the coloured chalks, and such a pity too, leaving them there to be all blotted out. The evening and the clouds coming out, and the Bailey light on Hoth, and to hear the music like that, and the perfume of those incense they burned in the church, like a kind of waft. And while she gazed, her heart went pitter-pat. Yes, it was her he was looking at, and there was meaning in his look. His eyes burned into her, as though they would search her through and through, read her very soul. Wonderful eyes they were, superbly expressive. But could you trust them? People were so queer. She could see at once by his dark eyes and his pale intellectual face that he was a foreigner. The image of the photo she had of Martin Harvey, the matinee idol, only for the moustache, which she preferred because she wasn't stage-struck, like Winnie Rippingham, that wanted they too to always dress the same on account of a play. But she could not see whether he had an aquiline nose or a slightly retroussé from where he was sitting. He was in deep mourning, she could see that, and the story of a haunting sorrow was written on his face. She would have given worlds to know what it was. He was looking up so intently, so still. and he saw her kick the ball, and perhaps he could see the bright steel buckles of her shoes if she swung them like that thoughtfully with the toes down. She was glad that something told her to put on the transparent stockings, thinking Reggie Wiley might be out. But that was far away. Here was that of which she had so often dreamed. It was he who mattered, and there was joy on her face, because she wanted him, because she felt instinctively that he was like no one else. The very heart of the girl-woman went out to him, her dream husband, because she knew on the instant it was him. If he had suffered, more sinned against than sinning, or even if he had been himself a sinner, a wicked man, she cared not. Even if he was a Protestant or Methodist, she could convert him easily if he truly loved her. There were wounds that wanted healing with heart balm. She was a womanly woman, not like other flighty girls, unfeminine, he had known, those cyclists showing off what they hadn't got, and she just yearned to know all, to forgive all if she could make him fall in love with her, make him forget the memory of the past. Then, mayhap, he would embrace her gently, like a real man, crushing her soft body to him, and love her, his ownest girlie, for herself alone. Refuge of sinners, comfortress of the afflicted, ora pro nobis. Well has it been said that whosoever prays to her with faith and constancy can never be lost or cast away, and fitly is she too a haven of refuge for the afflicted, because of the seven dolours, which transpierced her own heart. Gertie could picture the whole scene in the church, the stained glass windows lighted up, the candles, the flowers, and the blue banners of the Blessed Virgin's sodality, and Father Conroy was helping Canon O'Hanlon at the altar, carrying things in and out with his eyes cast down. He looked almost a saint, and his confession box was so quiet and clean and dark, and his hands were just like white wax, and if ever she became a Dominican nun in their white habit, perhaps he might come to the convent for the novena of St. Dominic. He told her that time when she told him about that, in confession, crimsoning up to the roots of her hair, for fear he could see. Not to be troubled, because that was only the voice of nature, and we were all subject to nature's laws, he said, in this life, and that was no sin, because that came from the nature of woman, instituted by God, he said, and that our Blessed Lady herself said to the Archangel Gabriel, "Be it done unto me according to thy word." He was so kind and holy, and often she thought and thought, could she work a ruched tea-cosy with embroidered floral design for him as a present, or a clock? But they had a clock, she noticed, on the mantelpiece, white and gold, with a canary bird that came out of a little house to tell the time. The day she went there about the flowers for the 40 hours adoration, because it was hard to know what sort of a present to give, or perhaps an album of illuminated views of Dublin or some place. The exasperating little brats of twins began to quarrel again, and Jackie threw the ball out towards the sea, and they both ran after it. Little monkeys, common as ditch-water. Someone ought to take them and give them a good hiding for themselves, to keep them in their places, the both of them. And Sissy and Edie shouted after them to come back, because they were afraid the tide might come in on them and be drowned. "Jackie! Tommy!" Not they. What a great notion they had. So Sissy said it was the very last time she'd ever bring them out. She jumped up and called them, and she ran down the slope past him, tossing her hair behind her, which had a good enough colour if there had been more of it. But with all the thingamery she was always rubbing into it, she couldn't get it to grow long because it wasn't natural. So she could just go and throw her hat at it. She ran with long, gandery strides. It was a wonder she didn't rip up her skirt at the side that was too tight on her, because there was a lot of the tomboy about Sissy Caffrey, and she was a forward piece whenever she thought she had a good opportunity to show off. And just because she was a good runner, she ran like that, so that he could see all the end of her petticoat running, and her skinny shanks up as far as possible. It would have served her just right if she had tripped up over something accidentally on purpose, with her high, crooked French heels on her, to make her look tall, and got a fine tumble. Tableau! That would have been a very charming exposé for a gentleman like that to witness. Queen of angels, queen of patriarchs, queen of prophets, of all saints, they prayed. Queen of the Most Holy Rosary. And then Father Conroy handed the thurible to Canon O'Hanlon, and he put in the incense and sensed the Blessed Sacrament. And Sissy Caffrey caught the two twins, and she was itching to give them a ringing good clip on the ear. But she didn't, because she thought he might be watching. But she never made a bigger mistake in all her life, because Gertie could see without looking that he never took his eyes off of her. And then Canon O'Hanlon handed the thurible back to Father Conroy and knelt down looking up at the Blessed Sacrament, and the choir began to sing the Tantum Ergo. And she just swung her foot in and out in time as the music rose and fell to the Tantum Ergo Sacramen Tum. 3 and 11 she paid for those stockings in Sparrows of George's Street on the Tuesday, no, the Monday before Easter, and there wasn't a brack on them. And that was what he was looking at, transparent. And not at her insignificant ones that had neither shape nor form, the cheek of her, because he had eyes in his head to see the difference for himself. Sissy came up along the Strand with the two twins and their ball, with her hat anyhow on her, to one side after her run, and she did look a streel, tugging the two kids along with the flimsy blouse she bought only a fortnight before, like a rag on her back, and a bit of her petticoat hanging like a caricature. Gertie just took off her hat for a moment to settle her hair, and a prettier, a daintier head of nut-brown tresses was never seen on a girl's shoulders. A radiant little vision, in sooth, almost maddening in its sweetness. You would have to travel many a long mile before you found a head of hair the like of that. She could almost see the swift answering flash of admiration in his eyes that set her tingling in every nerve. She put on her hat so that she could see from underneath the brim and swung her buckle shoe faster, for her breath caught as she caught the expression in his eyes. He was eyeing her as a snake eyes its prey. Her woman's instinct told her that she had raised the devil in him, and at the thought a burning scarlet swept from throat to brow, till the lovely colour of her face became a glorious rose. Edie Boardman was noticing it too, because she was squinting at Gertie, half-smiling, with her specs like an old maid, pretending to nurse the baby. Irritable little gnat she was, and always would be. And that was why no one could get on with her, poking her nose into what was no concern of hers. And she said to Gertie, "A penny for your thoughts." "What?" replied Gertie with a smile reinforced by the whitest of teeth. "I was only wondering, was it late?" Because she wished to goodness they'd take the snotty-nosed twins and their babby home to the mischief out of that, so that was why she just gave a gentle hint about it being late. And when Sissy came up, Edie asked her the time, and Miss Sissy, as glib as you like, said it was 1:30 kissing time, time to kiss again. but Edie wanted to know because they were told to be in early.
Wait, said Sissy. I'll run ask my Uncle Peter over there what's the time by his conundrum.
So over she went, and when he saw her coming, she could see him take his hand out of his pocket, getting nervous, and beginning to play with his watch-chain, looking up at the church. Passionate nature though he was, Gertie could see that he had enormous control over himself. One moment he had been there, fascinated by a loveliness that made him gaze, and the next moment it was the quiet, grave-faced gentleman, self-control expressed in every line of his distinguished-looking figure. Sissy said to excuse her, would he mind please telling her what was the right time? And Gertie could see him taking out his watch, listening to it, and looking up and clearing his throat. And he said he was very sorry his watch was stopped, but he thought it must be after 8 because the sun was set. His voice had a cultured ring in it, and though he spoke in measured accents, there was a suspicion of a quiver in the mellow tones. Sissy said thanks, and came back with her tongue out, and said Uncle said his waterworks were out of order. Then they sang the second verse of the Tantum Ergo, and Canon O'Hanlon got up again and sensed the Blessed Sacrament, and knelt down, and he told Father Conroy that one of the candles was just going to set fire to the flowers, and Father Conroy got up and settled it all right. And she could see the gentleman winding his watch and listening to the works, and she swung her leg more in and out in time. It was getting darker, but he could see, and he was looking all the time that he was winding the watch, or whatever he was doing to it, and then he put it back and put his hands back into his pockets. She felt a kind of a sensation rushing all over her, and she knew by the feel of her scalp and that irritation against her stays that that thing must be coming on, because the last time, too, was when she clipped her hair on account of the moon. His dark eyes fixed themselves on her again, drinking in her every contour, literally worshipping at her shrine. If ever there was undisguised admiration in a man's passionate gaze, it was there, plain to be seen on that man's face. It is for you, Gertrude MacDowell, and you know it. Edie began to get ready to go, and it was high time for her, and Gertie noticed that that little hint she gave had had the desired effect, because it was a long way along the Strand to where there was the place to push up the pushcar, and Sissy took off the twins' caps and tidied their hair to make herself attractive, of course. And Canon O'Hanlon stood up with his cope poking up at his neck, and Father Conroy handed him the card to read off, and he read out, Panem de Cielo Priestatisti Eis. And Edie and Sissy were talking about the time all the time, and asking her. But Gertie could pay them back in their own coin, and she just answered with scathing politeness when Edie asked her was she heartbroken about her best boy throwing her over. Gertie winced sharply. A brief cold blaze shone from her eyes that spoke volumes of scorn immeasurable. It hurt. Oh yes, it cut deep, because Edie had her own quiet way of saying things, like that she knew would wound, like the confounded little cat she was. Gertie's lips parted swiftly to frame the word, but she fought back the sob that rose to her throat, so slim, so flawless, so beautifully moulded, it seemed one an artist might have dreamed of. She had loved him better than he knew, light-hearted deceiver and fickle like all his sex. He would never understand what he had meant to her. And for an instant, there was in the blue eyes a quick stinging of tears. Their eyes were probing her mercilessly, but with a brave effort she sparkled back in sympathy as she glanced at her new conquest for them to see. "Oh," responded Gertie, quick as lightning, laughing, and the proud head flashed up. "I can throw my cap at who I like, because it's leap year." Her words rang out crystal clear, more musical than the cooing of the ringdove. But they cut the silence icily. There was that in her young voice that told that she was not a one to be lightly trifled with. As for Mr. Reggie, with his swank and his bit of money, she could just chuck him aside, as if he was so much filth, and never again would she cast as much as a second thought on him, and tear his silly postcard into a dozen pieces. And if ever after he dared to presume, she could give him one look of measured scorn that would make him shrivel up on the spot. Miss puny little Edith's countenance fell to no slight extent, and Gertie could see, by her looking as black as thunder, that she was simply in a towering rage, though she hid it, the little kinnat. Because that shaft had struck home for her petty jealousy, and they both knew that she was something aloof, apart, in another sphere. That she was not of them, and never would be. And there was somebody else, too, that knew it, and saw it. So they could put that in their pipe and smoke it. Edie straightened up Baby Boardman to get ready to go, and Sissy tucked in the ball and the spades and buckets, and it was high time, too, because the Sandman was on his way for Master Boardman Jr. And Sissy told him, too, that Billy Winks was coming and that Baby was to go dee-daw, and Baby looked just too ducky, laughing up out of his gleeful eyes. And Sissy poked him like that, out of fun, in his wee fat tummy. And Baby, without as much as by your leave, sent up his compliments to all and sundry onto his brand-new dribbling bib. "Oh, my puddeny pie," protested Sis. "He has his bib destroyed." The slight contretemps claimed her attention, but in tutus she set that little matter to rights. Gertie stifled a smothered exclamation and gave a nervous cough. And Edie asked what, and she was just going to tell her to catch it while it was flying. But she was ever ladylike in her deportment, so she simply passed it off with consummate tact by saying that that was the benediction, because just then the bell rang out from the steeple over the quiet seashore, because Canon O'Hanlon was upon the altar with the veil that Father Conroy put round his shoulders, giving the benediction with the Blessed Sacrament in his hands. How moving the scene there in the gathering twilight, the last glimpse of Erin, the touching chime of those evening bells, and at the same time a bat flew forth from the ivied belfry through the dusk, hither, thither, with a tiny lost cry. And she could see far away the lights of the lighthouses, so picturesque she would have loved to do with a box of paints, because it was easier than to make a man. And soon the lamplighter would be going his rounds past the Presbyterian church grounds and along by shady Tritonville Avenue, where the couples walked, and lighting the lamp near her window, where Reggie Wiley used to turn his free wheel, like she read in that book The Lamplighter by Miss Cummins, author of Mabel Vaughan and other tales. For Gertie had her dreams that no one knew of. She loved to read poetry, and when she got a keepsake from Bertha Supple of that lovely confession album, with the coral pink cover to write her thoughts in, she laid it in the drawer of her toilet table, which, though it did not err on the side of luxury, was scrupulously neat and clean. It was there she kept her girlish treasure trove, the tortoiseshell combs, her Child of Mary badge, the white rose scent, the eyebrow line, her alabaster pouncet box, and the ribbons to change when her things came home from the wash. And there were some beautiful thoughts written in it, in violet ink that she bought in Healy's of Dame Street, for she felt that she too could write poetry, if she could only express herself like that poem that appealed to her so deeply, that she had copied out of the newspaper she found one evening round the pot herbs. Art Thou Real, My Ideal, it was called, by Louis J. Walsh, Mara Felt. And after there was something about twilight, wilt thou ever? And oft-times the beauty of poetry, so sad in its transient loveliness, had misted her eyes with silent tears. For she felt that the years were slipping by for her, one by one. And but for that one shortcoming, she knew she need fear no competition. And that was an accident coming down Dorky Hill, and she always tried to conceal it. But it must end, she felt. If she saw that magic lure in his eyes, there would be no holding back for her. Love laughs at locksmiths. She would make the great sacrifice. Her every effort would be to share his thoughts. Dearer than the whole world would she be to him, and gild his days with happiness. There was the all-important question, and she was dying to know. Was he a married man, or a widower who had lost his wife? Or some tragedy like the nobleman with the foreign name from the land of song had to have her put into a madhouse, cruel only to be kind. But even if, what then? Would it make a very great difference? From everything in the least indelicate, her fine-bred nature instinctively recoiled. She loathed that sort of person. The fallen women of the accommodation walk beside the Dodder that went with the soldiers and coarse men with no respect for a girl's honour, degrading the sex and being taken up to the police station. No, no, not that. They would be just good friends, like a big brother and sister without all that other. In spite of the conventions of society with a big S, perhaps it was an old flame he was in mourning for, from the days beyond recall. She thought she understood. She would try to understand him, because men were so different. The old love was waiting, waiting with little white hands, stretched out with blue, appealing eyes. Heart of mine. She would follow her dream of love, the dictates of her heart that told her he was her all in all, the only man in all the world for her. For love was the master guide. Nothing else mattered. Come what might, she would be wild, untrammelled, free. Canon O'Hanlon put the Blessed Sacrament back into the tabernacle and genuflected, and the choir sang, Laudate Dominum Omnes Gentes. And then he locked the tabernacle door, because the benediction was over, and Father Conroy handed him his hat to put on. And Crosscat Edie asked, wasn't she coming, but Jackie Caffrey called out, Oh, look, Sissy! And they all looked. Was it sheet lightning? But Tommy saw it too over the trees beside the church, blue and then green and purple. It's fireworks, Sissy Caffrey said. And they all ran down the strand to see over the houses and the church, helter-skelter, Edie with the pushcar with baby boardman in it, and Sissy holding Tommy and Jackie by the hand so they wouldn't fall running. Come on, Gertie, Sissy called. It's the bazaar fireworks. But Gertie was adamant. She had no intention of being at their beck and call. If they could run like Rossies, she could sit, so she said. She could see from where she was. The eyes that were fastened upon her set her pulses tingling. She looked at him a moment, meeting his glance, and a light broke in upon her. White-hot passion was in that face. Passion silent as the grave. And it had made her his. At last they were left alone, without the others to pry and pass remarks. And she knew he could be trusted to the death. Steadfast, a sterling man, a man of inflexible honour to his fingertips. His hands and face were working, and a tremor went over her. She leaned back far to look up where the fireworks were, and she caught her knee in her hands, so as not to fall back looking up. And there was no one to see, only him and her, when she revealed all her graceful, beautifully shaped legs like that, supply soft and delicately rounded. And she seemed to hear the panting of his heart, his hoarse breathing, because she knew, too, about the passion of men like that, hot-blooded, because Bertha Supple told her once in dead secret and made her swear she'd never, about the gentleman lodger that was staying with them out of the Congested Districts Board, that had pictures got out of papers of those skirt dancers and high kickers, and she said he used to do something not very nice, that you could imagine sometimes in the bed. But this was altogether different from a thing like that. Because there was all the difference, because she could almost feel him draw her face to his, and the first quick hot touch of his handsome lips. Besides, there was absolution so long as you didn't do the other thing before being married. And there ought to be women priests that would understand without your telling out. And Sissy Caffrey, too, sometimes, had that dreamy kind of dreamy look in her eyes, so that she, too, my dear, and Winnie Rippingham, so mad about actors' photographs. And besides, it was on account of that other thing coming on the way it did. And Jackie Caffrey shouted to look, there was another. And she leaned back, and the garters were blue to match on account of the transparent. And they all saw it, and they all shouted to look, look, there it was. And she leaned back ever so far to see the fireworks, and something queer was flying through the air, a soft thing, to and fro, dark. And she saw a long Roman candle going up over the trees, up, up, and in the tense hush they were all breathless with excitement as it went higher and higher, and she had to lean back more and more to look up after it, high, high, almost out of sight, and her face was suffused with a divine, an entrancing blush from straining back, and he could see her other things too. Nainsook knickers, the fabric that caresses the skin, better than those other petty width, the green 4 and 11, on account of being white. And she let him, and she saw that he saw, and then it went so high it went out of sight a moment, and she was trembling in every limb from being bent so far back that he had a full view high up above her knee, where no one ever, not even on the swing or wading, and she wasn't ashamed, and he wasn't either, to look in that immodest way like that, because he couldn't resist the sight of the wondrous revealment half-offered like those skirt dancers, behaving so immodest before gentlemen, looking. And he kept on looking, looking. She would fain have cried to him chokingly, held out her snowy slender arms to him to come, to feel his lips laid on her white brow, the cry of a young girl's love, a little strangled cry wrung from her, that cry that has rung through the ages. And then a rocket sprang, and bang shot blind blank, and oh, then the Roman candle burst, and it was like a sigh of oh, and everyone cried oh, oh, in raptures, and it gushed out of it a stream of rain-gold hair-threads, and they shed, and ah, they were all greeny, dewy stars falling with golden, oh, so lovely, oh, soft, sweet, soft. Then all melted away, jewelly in the grey air. All was silent. Ah. She glanced at him as she bent forward quickly, a pathetic little glance of piteous protest, of shy reproach, under which he coloured like a girl. He was leaning back against the rock behind. Leopold Bloom, for it is he, stands silent, with bowed head before those young, guileless eyes. What a brute he had been. At it again. A fair, unsullied soul had called to him, and, wretch that he was, how had he answered? An utter cad he had been, he of all men. But there was an infinite store of mercy in those eyes, for him too a word of pardon, even though he had erred and sinned and wandered. Should a girl tell? No, a thousand times no. That was their secret, only theirs, alone in the hiding twilight, and there was none to know or tell, save the little bat that flew so softly through the evening, to and fro, and little bats don't tell.
This ends Disc 20.